The method.
Ideas. Method became
unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
Without doubt. Do you call it unsound method?
I don't see any method at all.
It's Christmas time, so we thought we'd do a sort of Christmas special. I am Jamie Batchin.
And I am Lachlan Bloom.
Just roundly off the air, because it's our first year of having the podcast.
Yeah.
And we've spoken to...
quite a lot of people.
Yeah. including the sort of double episodes we've had, and the episodes with events. Maybe 15 episodes we're up to.
Mm.
That's the basic elements of research that I really should have done before this, isn't it? But thank you for sticking with us, and this is your first time, in which case...
what have you been doing all year?
But please, it's all up there. Go back and have a listen. Do you feel that anything you've heard from the people we've spoken to this year is going to change your writing practice, or has changed your writing practice yet?
I think hearing how people go about it, it's made me more aware of some of the common themes and the sort of approach to researching and moving from an idea to the draft has been interesting, and how people do that. And
yeah.
So I think it's been more sort of an amalgamation of what different people have been saying and sort of letting it seep in rather than revelation.
I mean, I've been struck, I think, for my own writing and for my next project by the amount of people we've spoken to who really redraft the first time through. So they'll go back over the work and really, really pick at that until they feel happy with it.
Mm.
Because I think my technique has always been so far that the first draft is just bullshit, really. It's not bullshit, but it's almost assembling the building materials. You're not starting to build the structure, the building itself. It's getting everything together, and then I'll go back through and sort of work on it. I think it sounds really glib, but there's a bit of advice I heard from, I have no idea who, but it's like, don't get it right, get it written. And I think I really stuck to that. But quite a lot of the writers we've spoken to will go through and just really, really work it to start with.
Yeah, I think one thing I find interesting is that I feel there's sort of a split between people who have said they've had an image or some kind of central idea, normally an image though, as the impetus at the start of the novel, and then from there they've, you know, thought about it, taken notes, whatever, and ultimately ended up writing it. And those that have sort of not had any idea and started writing, and you know, the words have taken them where they've taken them. But it feels, I don't know how you feel on this split, it feels like sort of roughly 50-50 on...
Yeah, I think I can see that probably, yeah. And I wonder whether that is... I don't know how much credence I would give to these things, but when people say things like, oh, I'm a very visual person. I think in terms of how your memory works, maybe, I do tend to believe that that is true. So maybe just in the way that you are creative and imaginative, it holds for that as well. So yeah, like, yeah.
Yeah.
It could be.
I think it was Will Eaves was talking, that he'd had a specific image of
a necklace.
Yeah, a necklace.
Like bits, the bits of jewellery and everything that held it together. Yeah.
Which didn't really seem to have any connection to the novel. And I mean, not obviously, it's not a novel about a necklace, but that link from an image to the text seemed quite important to him. And like that seems to have come up a few times as well. But equally, there's people who've seemed to have claimed, or not claim, but have said they, you know, they've started writing and it's gone where it's gone, and it's not from any initial image or concept or anything.
Okay, so we thought it's Christmas. We're reviewing the year. It's been an interesting year. A lot's happened in 2018. We thought we would have a look at writing tips, the two sets of writing tips that are generally suggested to people when they say, oh, I'm interested in trying to write a book.
Mm.
So yeah, so we're going to look at...
Should we just dive into the... We've got eight
Shall I,
tips.
Yeah, I'll give you the first one.
You do Kurt, I'll do George.
Okay. So Kurt's first one is, use the time of a total stranger in such a way that he or she will not feel the time was wasted.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, I think on at a base level, I think that obviously makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
You're not wanting anybody to feel their time is wasted in any walk of life. I guess I struggle to see how that practically applies to the task of writing a short story or a novel. Even it's not something that immediately is at the forefront of my mind when writing something. And the idea of a waste of time or a useful use of time, I also don't really necessarily apply having read something. I don't feel, I mean, obviously sometimes you feel, oh, I've wasted my time reading that, but I don't think it's always 100% clear immediately after reading something what effect it's going to have on you further down the line.
Or... That's true, but then I wonder, like, is it like... I've always understood a shaggy dog story to be the kind of definition of a story that doesn't really go anywhere. Mm. Yeah. So is this piece of advice more saying that the writer has an obligation to have a sort of aim, to know what they're doing, where they want to go, and not just string the reader along? The next one, because I feel there's a lot to say about this, give the reader at least one character he or she can root for.
Mm. I mean, again, it seems eminently sensible to have the reader rooting for someone, but...
Is it essential?
I don't think it is, really.
It's tricky. I wish I had some good examples off the top of my head. I guess even if it's someone that you're not rooting for, the problem is, if it's someone in a negative way, someone who is being a real shit of the First Order... You're kind of rooting for the kind of natural justice of the universe to do something, perhaps. I don't know about that. I don't know if you need to feel... And I've got friends who've said that they hated books because there were no positive characters or they didn't like the protagonist. And I've always felt that that's probably missing the point of...
Mm. And I think, certainly a lot of the... Like, when you start getting into areas like psychogeography, then there's... lots of really good books that don't really have characters in that sense, that have issues to overcome or obstacles, and they're still really good books. It's really good writing, and it does something else.
That's it. Yeah, it's not asking. Well, it's not being a character driven piece.
Yeah.
So Kurt's third one is, every character should want something, even if it's only a glass of water.
Well, yeah, I guess it's kind of a flip side of the same of number two, in a sense, depending on where the writing is going.
I think there's something more structural to this, though. I think that there has to be motivation and there has to be some kind of drive. I'm slightly loath to call it narrative drive necessarily, but the characters, there's no point in having a character who's in there just because you've thought that Bob was a good name and wanted to have another guy in the pub called Bob.
Yeah.
I mean, if it really adds colour, maybe, but I don't know. I feel often, and this is something I feel in TV quite often as well, there are characters who could be dropped quite easily that just aren't doing enough work. But then that feels like quite a prescriptive thing that I've probably picked up from other books about writing, saying every character should want something.
They aren't a character. Like, every person wants something, I think, would be a better way of characterizing it. And if you're then including a human character in your book, they will want something by nature of them being human.
Maybe this is part of it, though, that a lot of people who begin writing, and, you know, we've been to writers' groups and I've been part of a creative writing course, often, and this can be a problem with female characters, I have to say, they're there because, you know, they're either the object of someone's affection or something like that. You know, they're not really a character in themselves. They're not ending themselves.
But then I suppose that does, that is a reflection perhaps of the writer not going deep enough to understand their motivations. But then that also can play a role in a certain type of writing to highlight the main character's lack of empathy or American Psycho, the main character is a psychopath.
Yeah.
And the role in writing the other characters is to show his relation to them and the lack of three dimensions that he perceives in them.
Okay, I'll say that's, I agree, but that is if the writer is choosing to do that and it's not through kind of neglect that it happens.
Mm-hmm.
So that, again, it has to be about the intent and understanding and being on top of the work that you're working on. So yeah, I can see that. So this one, again, especially with the sort of stuff that we discussed that we like reading, every sentence must do one of two things: reveal character or advance the action. This one is probably a problematic one.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely, for me, that seems to be leaning more to the sort of commercial branch of how to write a bestseller sort of tips rather than, I mean, a lot of the books and a lot of the novelists we've spoken to in the podcast, I don't think, I mean, I have to speak to them all individually what their thoughts are on it, but I don't think they would agree with that, and that you can have a beautifully constructed sentence that isn't necessarily doing either of those.
Although I would say that perhaps the argument could be that by having this beautifully constructed sentence, doing some playing on words in a certain way, that's revealing character of at least this sort of narrative voice that's being used. I think maybe that's being charitable sounds weird because I'm not trying to say it to justify it, but I think you can fit quite a lot into those two things.
Yeah. I mean, that's, I guess it depends how broad you're wanting to be, but then it kind of loses the, like, what isn't in the character of the narrative.
Yeah,
like,
I mean, it's saying don't have pointless non sequiturs, but then you could say, well, that's the character that I'm doing.
I mean, the character of the narrative voice in a sense is whatever the finished novel is to that reader, and so every sentence by default must advance that because it's getting one step closer to the end of the novel when the totality of the character, the narrative voice, is revealed. So it may be a bad narrative voice and you may not like it, but it's still revealing something even by having the most horrendously constructed sentence that doesn't do anything plot-wise or character-wise.
Yeah. I mean, it's revealing character. Yeah, I can go with that. We'll go for number 5 from Kurt, who says, start as close to the end as possible. Bear in mind, this is short stories, really, that he's talking about. In which case, I would say that's reasonably sound.
I guess it is different with writing short stories.
And obviously, it's a plot-based short story that you've got to be talking about here, because there's a lot of flash fiction and things that I would expect. That's not the point of what it's doing. It's the resolution.
Yeah, I mean, I thinking of writing a short story as opposed to something longer, I probably would have more of, like, the ending of it is kind of the starting point for me a lot more than, like, a novel. When I'm writing something longer, it's more, I guess I'm more in the camp of the image or the concept at the core of it, and then everything strings out from there rather than having the plot carefully written out beforehand.
I think it's, yeah, specifically to short stories, and that's a pretty good piece of advice. Number 6 is, be a sadist. No matter how sweet and innocent your leading characters, make awful things happen to them in order that the reader may see what they are made of.
Yeah, I think that is fairly good advice, I would say.
Yeah, I think it's, again, dealing with short stories and dealing with quite narrative, character-based fiction, I can sort of see that's a good thing.
Yeah.
I think on a personal level, I found it difficult for quite a long time to not just use death, for example, to be...
Yeah, I think there's a difference. But, I think that, I mean, that can also be taken quite broadly. And I think that on a sort of simple reading could, you can throw sort of the kitchen sink of disasters at the main character. If they get run over, they lose a leg, they lose a relative. The sort of physical material harm, but I mean, I think often the most interesting, like, sadism towards the character can be nothing happening at all, and a sort of ennui for the character, or a lack of what they want to happen materializing. And that doesn't necessarily have to be even written as an event. You know, nothing happens in the novel, but the ultimate effect of reading it is to realize the pain or damages has caused to the main character.
Yeah.
And you can, over hundreds of pages, inflict that pain on the character without ostensibly anything happening to them at all.
Yeah. Which,
I guess that's maybe not going to drive forward a sort of plot-driven narrative, but it's
still good. It depends what the character's initial sort of motivations are and what they're after. If that's what causes the frustration to them, then that could be, could be. Okay, number seven, and I feel that this probably goes against what agents and publishers would probably tell people in their advice. This is, write to please just one person. If you open a window and make love to the world, so to speak, your story will get pneumonia.
I kind of, was it number one? I can't remember where have we got to. Number one was, you can't let any reader feel it's a waste of time.
Absolutely, that was the first one, yes.
Yeah, which that, see, to me that seems slightly in conflict. As soon as you don't open the window and try to please everyone, then you're instantly acknowledging that certain people are going to find it a waste of time and other people are hopefully not. But
and I feel that's another piece of advice that people are given is don't write just for yourself. Mm. You're one person and you've got to assume that what you are interested in, there must be some other people who are interested in. So I think that's a difficult balance. I don't know. I'm not really sure about his metaphor about opening the window and making love to the world. Your story will get pneumonia. I mean,
there's a lot going on.
I'm not
sure
that he's gone through that in the most rigorous way possible.
I mean, what sort of climate has he got his window in?
If you open a window, the next bit is and make love to the world.
I'm not sure how that works. And then it doesn't follow that you open a window and get pneumonia. I mean, unless you live in a northern climate or far to southern climate.
I'm just not sure about the sort of coital logistics of opening a window. I don't think we should unpack that one. Kurt didn't feel it was worth his while giving it a proper amount of attention. I don't think...
It's way down at number seven. Yeah.
He doesn't say that it's in order of priority.
Oh. Well,
they're the eight tips for short stories.
Did he die of pneumonia?
I certainly hope not. Or the world needs to go to a clinic. So number eight is give your readers as much information as possible as soon as possible. Again, remember, we're talking about short stories. To heck with suspense. Readers should have such complete understanding of what is going on, where and why, that they could finish the story themselves should cockroaches eat the last few pages.
That's a tricky one, I think. I am not sure where I sit on that. I think the idea that the reader should instantly have a sense of the story's world, I think is really important. But the word information, I mean, I guess he was writing this long before the sort of explosion of information that we're deluged with today. I mean, what constitutes information that is the question that you're trying to answer in the novel.
I guess the sort of who, what, show, where, sorry, why, when. Don't hold things off for the sake of it, but yeah, it's... Yeah.
I mean, those are the decisions that are the act of writing the story out. I mean, what information are you giving and what are you holding back? You can describe something in the minutest of detail and actually not really give anything away about the situation in which it's unfolding. Or you can drop three words and have 90% of readers be 100% with where and what is going on.
And there can be a sort of a very artful withholding, can't there?
Yeah, yeah.
You would say that unreliable narration, really, the point is that you're not giving the reader all the information.
Yeah, yeah. And I think some of the best short stories absolutely operate in that withholding of information. But obviously there's the same number of words on the page, irrespective of what those words are. And you're going to give across some information with those words, but what that information is that, I mean, that is the job of the author, I would say.
Certainly. Kurt has a caveat. It's exactly the sort of thing you might be expecting at the end of this. He says, the greatest American short story writer of my generation was Flannery O'Connor, 1925 to 1964. Helpfully got here. I don't think Kurt said it in that way, I would imagine. He says, she broke practically every one of my rules but the first. Great writers tend to do that. So that caveat really is...
I'm presuming he means...
Pull the rug out.
In general, they break rules, or does he mean they break all...
All but one.
All but all one, but or all but the first. I mean, we were just saying it's not an order. But
again, that's...
if every great writer does not break the first rule, then that gives it a kind of... precedence over the other seven.
But I see what he's saying is,
break the rules.
Or if once learn the rules and then you can break the rules. But you got to learn them first.
Yeah.
So I think that sums up Kurt Vonnegut's 8 tips for short stories. Mm-hmm. I feel I've been over familiar by calling him Kurt consistently, but it's done now.
It's done, yeah. So we're now going to move on to George Orwell and his tips from Politics and the English Language. And George, I feel we should refer to him as George.
We've set this. Eric, technically.
Eric, stroke George, writes, a scrupulous writer in every sentence that he writes will ask himself at least 4 questions. Thus, number 1... what am I trying to say? Number 2, what words will express it? Number 3, what image or idiom will make it clearer? And 4, is this image fresh enough to have an effect?
I think that's quite good. Because when you go back and edit things, a lot of it is getting rid of redundant writing, isn't it? I mean, it's stuff that's repeated or stuff that's saying the same thing again, just not in... as precise a way as it could do, so you go back and refine it. I think the thing about the like metaphors, images, is quite good, because I think you do need to, not to get too sort of Martin Amis about it, but it is about trying to avoid cliche, isn't it? I think it's that does make language very dead, and I think it's very easy to fall into that with everyday speech anyway. When you're reading writing, suddenly you can just read something that's written in such a precise way that it just strikes you immediately. How would I never thought about it this way before?
Yeah. And I think it's interesting comparing these writing tips, or I guess they're more writing questions, against the style of the earlier 8 that we discussed. That, you know, they're very much, to me, they seem more about the motivation for writing it and less about the practicalities of what you're putting down on the page, which I think is a lot more what is interesting in good fiction. And all the writers we've spoken to so far in the podcast, are my sense is they're coming at things through the motivation to try and express things through their writing, rather than trying to construct a sort of plot.
I think that sounds about right. Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, I kind of agree broadly with all of those. I mean, I guess they're all fairly general, and it's maybe hard to read those and translate that into what you practically do to write something, which I guess it's only experience in writing. You kind of start to understand that you go back and edit something and realize, that looked like it was good, but actually I'm not really... my words aren't expressing what I wanted them to say, or this is not really reflecting the image or idiom that I thought it was. So these are more tips from George Orwell. He will probably ask himself two more questions. Could I put it more shortly? And have I said anything that is avoidably ugly?
I mean, wow, that's... More shortly, I think, is good. I think you can... Again, this is when you go back through editing, and if you're being sensible about it and respecting the work, there will often be things you can cut out. I would never want to be so prescriptive to say get rid of all your adverbs or anything like that, which I think is the sort of advice you do here. But in general, you probably, or in speaking for myself, my own writing, when I find ways that I can do it more shortly, that is because I haven't been able to be as precise as I wanted. And by reworking it and being more succinct, it is far more apt and what I'm after.
Yeah. I think, I mean, it's that to me is definitely a kind of editing advice. And it may be, I think you often, looking back at something, if you have a sense that there is a question of it being written more shortly, then it's an indication that there may be something more to explore that, or there's an issue there, and that might be that you end up turning a sentence into three pages because what you thought you'd captured is actually something deeper underneath. Or it may be that you just cut the sentence in half. But the fact that that question is coming up is an indication that there's an issue with the text, normally.
Absolutely. I'd say. I can see that, yeah. I think what was the second part of that?
Have I said anything that is avoidably ugly, which is...
I mean, that's tricky, especially for less mainstream fiction, because there could be...
Ugliness is an unusual concept, I think, in terms of fiction. I struggle to understand exactly what it means.
I mean, there are layers to this. I often, like, for my own shorthand, say that something is clunky because it's not quite... It's not really about efficiency, elegance more, I'm not quite sure, but it's not as finessed as it could be. But ugly feels, I don't know, that slightly smacks of a kind of idea about the sort of canon and what's, you know, an aesthetic thing that is acceptable and agreed. Like, those people, the gatekeepers have agreed this is all right.
And I mean, I think there is a natural rhythm that the ear or the brain reading a text has, and I guess sentences and the rhythm within the text can be more elegant to an extent. But that, to me, that doesn't signify very much in terms of what I rate the text as ultimately. Like the rhythm and cadence of the sentences may be really great when you end up with a novel that is not really very satisfying and an actual fact kind of irritating more irritating than something that was written badly. And
it's about the, again though, I think the intention about if it's through carelessness and not giving it enough thought that it's sort of gone that way, then that's okay, but I think that's a problem that he's addressing. I mean, but I think in music, for example, you would say things like, "Oh yeah, the ear is attuned to melody and harmony and things like that," and that's how we know what's right in a piece of music. But you would say that, you know, Kevin Shields spends half his time out of tune the way he plays guitar, and that's kind of exactly the point, is that it's the sort of shift.
But then I think there's
knows what he's doing.
There's another element as well, which I think also applies in writing. It, you know, I don't think, like the Sex Pistols say, they'd not chosen the sound having studied to the highest nth degree and specifically chosen those sounds. Those are the sounds that came out from them doing their thing, and that's how it was, and that's how it is. And you can like the Sex Pistols or not, but it's not because Johnny Rotten and Sid Vicious spent hours and hours listening to different guitar noises and bass sounds and becoming connoisseurs of the craft of creating punk music. They just used whatever was to hand and they made some noise, and you know, they came up with the Sex Pistols.
So, yeah, well, it did the job it needed.
McLaren,
to.
yeah, I think there's an element of that in writing as well. That you can have really good writing that doesn't necessarily have that awareness of the rhythm and cadence, but still does something really powerful. And
So you think that kind of, there's something about the composition of a novel where maybe I don't buy that quite as much, because I think you could have very, very untrained punk music, or those sort of forms of dance music you could make, just very sort of raw rhythms. Mm. And sort of art, visual art, you know, very sort of brutal stuff, naive art. I think the amount of work it takes to make a picture or a 3-minute song is different to composing a novel. And I'm not saying you could, I'm saying that there could be people who are naturally talented and they do it in a sort of artless seeming way, maybe. I'd go along with that. But I don't think that someone who is just a complete chancer can churn out without, at the very least, the amount of exposure that you get just from going to school and reading books and talking about it in English classes just gives you some preparation.
Yeah, I mean, there's probably another, like, hurdle, an additional hurdle in
The Sex Pistols weren't going to churn out symphonies, probably. And that's not what they were trying to do. And I'm not saying that's a criticism of them. I just think there's something about the
I think there's an immediacy that music or other art forms has that it makes it easier for people to connect or to put their ideas onto it. Whereas words on the page are inherently sort of inert.
Mm.
It takes a good deal of work from the reader to turn black and white markings on a page into some kind of mental world that they inhabit.
So yeah,
there is that extra hurdle. I mean, you could make a noise with an electric guitar without knowing anything about music or anything about guitars at all, but to create a sentence, yeah, I think it does take more work. But I suppose I don't know where I sit entirely on the need to kind of know all the rules before you can break them when it comes to that.
Yeah, I don't know how committed I am to it, really, thinking about it now, but I just feel that it's never going to be a hindrance to have a look at the rules as they have been accepted by them, you know.
Yeah,
just have an idea about that is not ever going to be a harmful thing, I don't think.
But I wonder, I mean, going back to the Sex Pistols, I wonder how, if they had invested time in learning more about musical theory and technique of musicianship, I mean, it would be harmful in the sense that they wouldn't be the band that they were. And I think that it would also, you could have the same argument in terms of writers, that it is an investment of time and an investment of attention and focus to go down a particular path of learning about these rules. And you know, there may be lots of writers out there who have amazing things to say in structures and ways that we've not come across before that would be harmed by sort of being fed through a system that prioritizes certain types of, I guess, going back to the point of ugliness versus whatever George Orwell was seeing as the opposite of ugliness, which is presumably desirable. I think there is a, certainly in the moment within sort of mainstream publishing, there is a sort of desire for a certain sort of beauty that is quite superficial.
Yeah.
And that can be quite detrimental for writers, I think, who see that as the goal, to write a beautifully plotted and beautifully, each sentence flows nicely and has a rhythm, but ultimately it's not saying anything or doing anything.
Finely polished, but with no substance.
Yeah. I think there's a...
I can see, yeah. I'll go along with that. I mean, Having said that, I think it's important to learn the rules to then break the rules. I have a sort of instinctive antipathy towards any sets of rules. Anyone who set themselves up and say, you know, these are the rules, this is the way to do things. So I think my own point is sort of undermined by that. What's George got for us next?
Okay, speaking of rules, on to the next. He writes, one can often be in doubt about the effect of a word or a phrase, and one needs rules that one can rely on when instinct fails. I think the following rules will cover most cases. Number one, never use a metaphor, simile, or other figure of speech which you're used to seeing in print.
I think we've kind of covered that with one of his earlier comments, haven't we? And I would agree that where possible, do try to avoid it. I guess it's one of those things, isn't it, that cliches are cliches for a reason. Mm. But also, we spoke earlier about dead language that you get from cliche, and I think that is true. I'll buy that.
I think on that briefly, I think there is a... language is never fully dead. Like, there's always the potential to resuscitate. And I think it depends on where the cliche sits within language and culture, but especially with sort of more ingrained cliches that are maybe the structure of them is not really understood at all. The kind of excavating that can actually be quite interesting, taking a cliche that's a figure of speech that nobody actually ever really considers the component words and what they mean, and by dissecting that you have something new.
I think there's absolutely a place for that, but that's doing something slightly different to what I think. I completely agree that there's certainly a place for sort of subverting the cliches or just looking at how they work and the assumptions that we make because we hear them so often.
So number two, never use a long word where a short one will do.
Yeah. I mean,
I think that sums it up.
There's something about precision though, isn't there? But I get where he's coming from. I'm just trying to think if that's a kind of inverted snobbery or a sort of English philistinism that we get. I'm just trying to... I haven't properly considered my feelings about this. Because I think it's something that puts people's backs up, isn't it? About if people are too sort of verbose or people use words and people sort of think, there's no need to speak like that. But is that can often just add colour to life anyway, can't it? I'm not saying that it would be hell if everyone spoke like Boris Johnson, but I don't think that necessarily, and there's a point coming up that I do have strong feelings about that is similar to this. But a short word... use a long word where a short one would do. In general, yes, because I don't think writing should, in general, draw attention to itself unnecessarily. So I'd say that's what I think this rule helps with.
I mean, I think it's unclear what will do means. I mean, presumably you never want any sentence to just suffice and not be the best it can be. So... I don't think he's meaning, oh, that'll do. That's fine. It's not great, but that'll do. He means it will completely encapsulate what the longer word
absolutely,
is doing in
yeah.
that sentence, which it's
completely exchangeable. It's just a shorter word. Then
And I think, I mean, generally, I think the beauty of shorter words is that they are quite often more open and there's more resonance with different meanings. Like the longer a word is, the more precise its meaning, and the lack of synonyms or the lack of alternate meanings there are for that word. Whereas a shorter word would generally have multiple meanings.
That's interesting. I need to go away and have a think about that. Is that true?
I think, I mean...
It instinctively feels like it's true, but I'm just... That's interesting.
And I think you can... You're risking... I mean, one of the meanings of the shorter word may completely coincide with the meaning of the longer word, and you swap it in, but you're then risking, or depending how you look at it, you're opening up a range of other alternate interpretations, which I think, you know, I think that's what's interesting about language and sort of the fiction that we write and read is where you have those ambiguities. And so I mean, I just kind of agree in that sense that a shorter word is, there's benefits of that from that point of view.
So you add more textual depth perhaps by using short words that can have more things.
I'm just thinking, like the deconstruction in English, especially like the longer words, I think tend to be more Latin roots, while the shorter words also tend to be more Saxon.
You've got a theory behind this as well. I mean, I don't know. That feels on the face of it like that is true. I just feel like I need to go and sit down with a pen and paper and have a proper think about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's I don't know. There may be some theory behind this, but so move on to the number three. If it is possible to cut a word out, always cut it out. I would kind of agree with that. I mean, do it. I mean, you might put it back in again, though.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd have that caveat.
If it is possible to. Sometimes the rhythm of the sentence will rely on a syllable of a word that you could get rid of.
Mm.
But by having it there, it just...
I would add the caveat to that. Do it. Take it out. Then see how you feel. If it doesn't feel right, put it back in again.
Yeah.
Which is possibly going against what he meant by that. I presume he meant take it out and leave it out. But I think there are cases to, you know, have words that could be cut out in there for the rhythm or so on.
In general, aim for kind of an efficiency.
Mm.
But sometimes you might want to put one back. I mean, yeah, go along with it.
Okay, number four. Never use the passive where you can use the active.
Never.
Never.
I agree that I think it is a mistake made by writers when they're starting out, and I'm certainly one of them, that you use a passive voice too much. But yeah. I never, never use... and I think generally it goes with some of the things that came before in terms of taking words out. You will often find if you use the active voice, it will be a shorter sentence because you're not having to do these kind of linguistic acrobatics or tie yourself up in knots because you're using the passive voice. So,
but yeah, I mean, depends. I'd say it depends what you're trying to do. I mean, it exists as a register in human communication. By accident.
What's the message that you're trying to get across? But I would say in general, as a reader, that's a reasonably solid point, but then again, there's an effect to be had by not going on.
I mean, that seems to tie more into Kurt Vonnegut's earlier ones that are a lot more practical, and I could see that is a... I 100% agree with that. If you're trying to write something commercial and immediate to as wide an audience as possible, but not everything is written like that.
Yeah.
So we go on to number five. Never use a foreign phrase, a scientific word, or a jargon word if you can think of an everyday English equivalent.
I have strong feelings about the first part of this. And I'm going to say something that probably jars in my earlier comment about English philistinism. And I don't really want to make myself guilty of that. But having read a lot of literature especially from Victorian times, and especially the early 20th century... And I get that, room of one's own, etc. People who are wealthy will tend to be able to sit down and write books, and they will often have had an expensive education. But fuck you for writing long passages of Latin or French and not including a footnote or any translation. Because seriously, I don't know what other form of art you do that in. And I know, especially with the internet, I can go and have a look, I can look up what it is, but that means I'm going to stop reading and I'm going to go and have a look, and most of the time I just think, I can't be asked this, why is it in here? I'm sure there's other points about efficiency, getting rid of words. What is it doing other than just not virtue, but it's like knowledge signaling, isn't it? And yeah. I really, really, really has pissed me off since I was a teenager. And I, it winds me up. But I will say that I have myself used foreign phrases. When you, if you set something somewhere, but the context makes it really obvious. And it will be something clear, like, you know, just a colloquial word that people say to say goodbye or something like that. It's flipping obvious what it is, but it really, really knobs me off when there's, I mean, I've been very slowly working my way through Tristram Shandy, which is far more of a grind than it should be, considering the sort of writing I'm interested in. And their entire chapters in Latin, and I just, oh.
It sounds like that. That's a definite agreement.
And it becomes a kind of class thing for me. And I feel bad about that. But just most people now in Britain reads, and there's probably not many contemporary novels that do have a lot of Latin in it. But it does kind of, there will be a certain background of person who is likely to be able to read Latin. And I would like to have a bit more. I'm not going to have any pride in being a monoglot or anything like that. I'd like to know more. But it's something about the assumptions that are made.
Yeah, I think for me, it's, I don't think I've had, not had such a violent reaction to the inclusion of foreign language and, or yeah, like a dead language like Latin that nobody's speaking it. But I mean, I can see, sometimes I absolutely agree, is just added as a kind of knowledge signaling on the part of the author. But I think sometimes, especially when the novel is dealing with the issues around translation and those sort of things, which I think, I mean, that's a whole, we should do another podcast actually on translation. I think we've had like some interesting guests so far this year who've been writing in a foreign language to English, and they're, you know, we've only read them in translation, but the issues around translation are a multitude, and I think that they kind of tie directly into the core of what good writing is. And so when the author is exploring that in the text and they include something, that the confusion around what that means is, can be central to the story. But when it is, could equally have been written in the same language as the rest of the book, and it doesn't add anything other than to virtue signal, then it,
it's and I say this as someone who is really interested in other languages and, you know, learning other languages, and with translation, the whole intellectual exercise of translating a work from one language into another. But I think, especially on this weird little island, for too long for too much of our history, there is just voices of a certain section of society that we hear, and that continues in novels. And if the fact there's a lot of Latin in, or French back in the day, although hopefully a lot more people know a bit of French now, by having a lot of Latin, you're saying this is a book by someone who is of the upper classes, upper middle class, whatever you want, written for people of that same group, and because of the sort of cultural, like, hegemonic grip they've got, it's far more likely to be then held up as good literature as a result of it. And there's that sort of feedback loop that, I hate to sound like an inverted snob about it, but it sort of just reinforces that, like, Latin is this good thing, and it's not just another language amongst many others, unless obviously you are a citizen of the Vatican City and it's what you use day to day, I'm sure.
Yeah, I think we've got quite a few listeners
in Vatican. I'll check our stats and see how many people are listening from the Vatican.
Surely in the hundreds of thousands.
Sorry if disrespect. I mean, obviously you guys are fine to write in Latin, but that's not about being a product of the British public schools. What was the other thing? Scientific word or jargon word? Now, I think, I'm not sure about this. Scientific words and jargon words can sometimes really add a sort of flavor of what you're doing, and you can play some nice games with it. So I don't know about that.
Yeah, and also I don't know when this was written, but I'd imagine our use of scientific words in everyday language is probably a lot higher now. I mean, I'm just guessing that than when George Orwell wrote this. Probably a lot more familiar with a wider range of scientific terms, just with the prevalence of technology, and, you know, everyday life has changed since then. So, yeah, I agree. I wouldn't
necessarily. It depends what you're writing. And if it's like signaling how smart you are, that's the problem.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of really bad fiction where these sort of words start dropping in to fill a gap rather than to add anything. I guess the idea is that it's going to make it seem somehow more intelligent than it is just by putting in certain words, which I think is the real danger.
Rather than it actually having intelligence behind it.
So in number 6 of his rules, break any of these rules sooner than say anything outright barbarous.
Okay. saying something, I mean, I don't know. In principle, I would agree. Break any of those rules rather than something. But I don't know about saying anything outright barbarous. I mean,
I guess this ties back to his earlier rule about avoiding anything that was ugly. And, I get what you were saying about the sort of canon and the kind of class that it was associated with writing fiction, certainly historically. I think that's undoubtedly true. I mean, the only people who had the time for most of history were aristocrats or the like. At the same time, I think there is the idea of a canon and a kind of curation of what does or doesn't get in, create certain norms and bounds of what the books are, and it's not clear to me that completely getting rid of any idea of canon or any kind of gatekeepers doesn't have issues with it associated with it. Obviously, who those people are is then a whole other debate. But whether those people at all is, I think there definitely are potentially benefits.
I agree. It's about who they are and what the agenda is behind it, I guess, as well.
But I mean, I guess whoever, whichever people they are, and whatever agenda they are, it will be a agenda and a certain group of people which excludes others and sets other agendas.
It's always going to be problematic. I used to love like top 100 lists when I was in my like late teens, early 20s, I guess. Things like the top 100 albums and stuff like that. And you just realise how absurd that is after a while. But I know what you mean in terms of a canon, in terms of if you work back from the writing that you really love and that you're interested in, and then you can see the sort of family tree behind it. I mean, there's something for that and being able to navigate that pathway as much as people are consciously influenced by things. It's sort of, we need to question the role of the people who are putting themselves forward to do it.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of see that on the one hand, there's a sort of Amazon flood the market with products, and it doesn't really matter what the products are. The ones that sell will be the good ones, and the ones that don't sell, well, who cares about them? And on the flip side, there's this sort of very gatekeeper-led model, which I think a lot of the writing we're interested in is still sort of within that gatekeeper model, and it's certainly not battling it out in the Amazon bestseller lists on ebook sales, because that's a whole different concept of what.
Yeah, there's something interesting you say about this actually, from what I was saying just a moment ago about finding out who's influenced the writers you're interested in and working that out, and speaking about Amazon. And I'm interested in what our listeners think about this. I think if you aren't completely conventional with your tastes, Amazon have very, very complex algorithms where they will suggest to you things that you want to buy. Now there's a few more sponsored links, but it used to be they would work out people who've bought what you've bought and suggest things. And I would say I have never, ever bought something because of the suggestion from Amazon. And that's not on principle. That's because their algorithm doesn't work once you get off the beaten track, in my opinion. I think this goes for music and that I'm really aware of, books as well.
Yeah, yeah, and I agree. The same.
It's interesting. You think that, I don't know what's going on with the, and no one knows what's going on with the algorithm, but I wonder what it is that it just can't begin, other than it will say other work by the same person. But it's never, I haven't ever suddenly realized, like, I was reading these two writers who are quite similar, and then this third one, like, Amazon just threw it up and it was, yeah, it was there. It'll be like, it's, I don't know, a celebrity autobiography that they're suggesting or something. I just don't get it.
I mean, it may be that it's just not evolved to the level that it can get to the sort of more niche writing, or maybe that's just not a concern. Their concern is if they can sell you one bestseller, or maybe, you know, one bestseller every 6 months. That's better than suggesting the books you actually like, and, you know, you're maybe not going to buy them from Amazon anyway. So, that's a good recommendation. Thanks, Amazon.
Don't buy stuff from Amazon unless it's large as well. We say that as people who are very much supported by independent presses who you can buy from directly, and a lot of the fantastic bookshops. So let's avoid Amazon where we can. Yeah. Their algorithms don't work, but I worry that the future of curation might be those sort of algorithms rather than a kind of curated canon. Time will tell.
Time will tell. I think that's all the writing tips we've got for this episode, and indeed this year.
Yes, thank you for joining us and for just making our first year really far more successful than we were expecting it to be.
Do like and subscribe wherever you find this podcast, and
have a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Cheers.
Cheers.